Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. You can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about upcoming guests, features, events, and other shows on our network. If you have any questions or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please visit us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to questions@theorganicview.com. In this special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my co-host Tom Theobald and I will be joined by former EPA Enforcement Inspector Mr. Dan Bench to discuss his experience with the EPA as well as his 35 years as a beekeeper. However, before we begin, I would like to explain the purpose of this agency, especially to those folks that live outside the United States. In the USA, the agency whose mission is to protect human health and the environment is called the Environmental Protection Agency, or otherwise known as EPA. The EPA's purpose is to ensure that all Americans are protected from significant risks to human health and the environment where they live, learn, and work. National efforts to reduce environmental risk are based on the best available scientific information. Federal laws protecting human health and the environment are enforced fairly and effectively. Environmental protection is an integral consideration in U.S. policies concerning natural resources, human health, economic growth, energy, transportation, agriculture, industry, and international trade. And these factors are similarly considered in establishing environmental policy. All parts of society, communities, individuals, businesses, and state and local and tribal governments have access to accurate information sufficient to effectively participate in managing human health and environmental risks. Environmental protection contributes to making our communities and ecosystems diverse, sustainable, and economically productive, and the United States plays a leadership role in working with other nations to protect the global environment. This definition is found on the EPA's website. So I would first like to welcome to the show my co-host, Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, June.
And
hello, Dan.
And our guest today, Mr. Dan Bench. Good afternoon, Mr. Bench, and welcome to the show.
Hello, June. Thank you.
Mr. Bench, if you would be so kind, could you please tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you grew up?
Okay. I grew up as a very small child following a seismograph crew around in the western United States and living in a house trailer. And my father was a geologist. And I think that's what really gave me my beginning interest in the outdoors and ecology. I didn't move into a city until I was about 9, and then I grew up in Denver. And about that time when we moved into Denver, I had decided to go to the School of Mines, and I did that and got a degree in mining engineering. And then after I got out of school, there weren't any jobs, but I ended up getting some jobs, and I worked as a miner for about 3 years. And then after that, I went to work for the EPA because I was looking for a job, and that's where the job was. Fortunately, I could find a job that fit very well with my commitments because I've always been aware of the environment and concerned about it.
Thank you. Can you explain what your position entailed at the EPA?
Well, I had two big major positions. The first one is I worked in the pesticide program as an enforcement officer, and that meant I went out in the field and made sure that people were following the label and applying the pesticides correctly. And if they weren't, the agency would generally issue a civil administrative complaint to get the problem resolved. I left the pesticide program in about 1978 because I didn't feel like I was getting very much done on the big picture, and went to work on the PCB program. And I felt that was a good move, and I felt I got quite a bit done in control of PCBs.
Thank
Dan,
you.
Dan, you've been a beekeeper for 35 years, so you began beekeeping not long after you went to work for the EPA. And I think you and I probably met at about the time you started keeping bees, so we've known each other for that whole 35 years. I guess you would be what we would call a hobbyist beekeeper, but at times you had as many as 20 colonies, and you had them in a number of different environments. Can you just describe for the listeners what your beekeeping experience is beginning back then and maybe bringing this up to today?
Well, yeah, you're right, Tom. I have been a beekeeper for about 35 years, maybe as much as 36. And during that time, I had bees continuously up until just recently. I first started bees, and I can't even tell you why. I've always been interested in the natural world, and I thought they'd make good pets. I got a book, and I got some bees, and I was as scared of bees as anybody else. And for a while, I worked with my bees because I didn't want to spend any money, dressed up in a green ski parka. And what I discovered is that is a signal for trouble. And it wasn't too long before I was afraid of my bees. And when I first got a honey harvest, I was so afraid of the bees, I was very angry at them for having produced all that honey. I had to take off of them. Nevertheless, I did learn, and I got a bee suit. And from then on, everything was fine. And I had a good time keeping bees all this time. I had them in a number of different locations, and I always had bees around me at the house, and I found out once you have bees, once a beekeeper, always a beekeeper.
You've had bees in the foothills, you've had bees in Boulder, you've had bees in Denver, and you were generally successful at your beekeeping, weren't you? You had a honey crop every year, as I recall.
As a matter of fact, I did have a honey crop every year, and for a long time I had about 20 colonies for quite a few years, and I was getting 70 or 80 pounds of surplus honey every year. It was very successful. I very rarely lost a colony of bees during that time.
Which brings us to the present. We had a conversation this spring. You called me in June because you were having what you thought was a very good honey flow at a somewhat unusual time of the year, and you wondered where it was coming from. Can you just describe that conversation for the listeners?
We had contacts on and off all these years about managing bees, so that's why I contacted you. Because I really had had a very good harvest, and I wasn't sure exactly where it came from. And you apprised me that it's very likely coming from the linden trees. Well, I realized that there's linden trees all over the place. And I also knew that linden trees are really a good source of honey. They're big, beautiful, fragrant trees. The flowers are fragrant. They're cream-colored, and if you ever see one, you'll never forget it. These things are very, very popular with the bees. And one of those trees is probably worth an acre or two of flowers. What you had said to me was that this is good, this is very good, but you should keep a watch on your bees this fall. And I had done that in the past, and everything looked all right. And this year, everything looked all right in the fall. I'd seen a couple of early warning signs, but I discounted them. After the honey harvest in September, late September, I went out to weigh the colonies. And what I found was, much to my surprise, where I'm usually leaving 80 to 100 pounds of honey to get them through the winter, these colonies were weighing about 20 pounds. And so, of course, I got into them right away because everything had looked all right on the outside. I didn't even think I needed to get into them. And what I found was just a very diminished quantity of bees in there, no brood, no eggs, and almost no honey. Those colonies, I knew, were doomed within a couple of weeks. And the consequence is I lost all of my bees.
And our guess was something that we've had a problem with for the past several years, a product called Merit. Can you talk a little bit about Merit? What is Merit?
Well, Merit is a Bayer product. One of the things that Merit is registered for is use on trees like linden trees, and it's applied.
How do they administer it?
Well, it can be applied in a number of ways. You can spray the tree. It can be inoculated, or it can be applied as a drench, that is, a liquid in the dissolved in water in the roots. In any of these cases, or all of these cases, what happens is this is a systemic persistent pesticide, and the active ingredient, which is clothianidin and imidacloprid, is absorbed into all of the plant tissues and is finally expressed in the flowers, that is, in the nectar and the pollen. It's also expressed in what they call gutation drops, which are drops of water along the edges of the plant and leaves, and insects often drink from these things. All of these sources, water, gutation water, pollen, nectar, become toxic to any pollinator that visits that tree. So essentially what happens is the tree companies apparently sell these applications to unsuspecting homeowners and say, we don't have to spray. We can do this with a drench, or we can inoculate your tree, and you're protecting the environment. Little do the homeowners know that they're putting a poison pill into the environment, and they're doing it for a long term because this is a persistent pesticide.
Well, yeah, and part of the problem is it seems that they have the best of intentions. It's presented to them as something that isn't sprayed, isn't going to drift onto their neighbor's property, and isn't going to cause anyone else problems. You have a conversation, several conversations with one of the local arborists. Can you tell us what that consisted of?
Well, yes, it was a local arborist that I have had a number of contacts with, because here's a fellow who pays attention to the environment. And he told me that he had his trees treated 8 or 9 years ago before he realized what the problem was with these neonicotinoids, just like I had problems at that time too and didn't know what it was. But he noticed within a day all of his bees were dead. And he said that after 8 years of having an inoculation, he said he has never seen any aphids on that tree. So he's of the opinion that this stuff is still active in that tree after all that time.
Mr. Bench, could you please explain to our audience how it's possible that these types of products are on the market and homeowners have the opportunity to purchase them without really understanding just how severe the impact can be by applying these types of products?
These products are on the market essentially because EPA has the law, the pesticide law, allows EPA to issue what they call a conditional registration. And what that amounts to is that they can put on the market, on their judgment, without having proper tests, any pesticide that they choose. And apparently it looks like often this is done with the idea of helping the company out. And it appears that EPA has, at least this portion of EPA, has kind of lost its focus. And its real interest, from all indications that we can see, is first protect the chemical companies, and then maybe they'll pay attention to the environment. I haven't seen much efforts to protect the environment in this case. The consequence is people are applying pesticides that have not been properly tested.
Thank you. Mr. Brink, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Well, what I was going to ask is, Dan, you've had an opportunity that very few of us have, and that is you've seen the EPA from the inside. What do you think the level of understanding is among the EPA employees with regard to this, what appears to be a very, very serious environmental problem? What's the level of understanding in the EPA?
EPA is kind of a specialized agency. That is, you have a lot of people who work on water, you have people that work on pesticides, you have people that work on air pollution. And the consequence is the pesticide program doesn't seem to have much interest in this problem or understanding, and the consequence is the rest of the agency doesn't understand very much about it either. And the reason is once a conditional registration is issued, both the agency personnel and the general public wrongly concludes just because the agency says you can use it, it's okay.
The conditional registration is an issue of controversy. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what that means? What does conditional mean?
Well, what that means is that registration is issued that allows the pesticide to be used on certain uses and sold on the market pending the receipt of certain studies the EPA requires. And in the case of clothianidin, I believe the conditional registration was issued in 2003 with a proviso that Bayer supply a life study cycle on the bees within a year. And I believe it took 8 years for this study to appear. And during 8 years, I have no idea what EPA did, but they certainly didn't fulfill their responsibilities. And when the study finally came in, I was speechless when I saw it, because this is something any fourth grader would know better than to submit, and most certainly any fourth grader would know better than to accept. This is a study where they put bees in a very small patch of canola, which had been, the seeds had been treated. We're talking about, I think it was four plots of 2.5 acres, and right in those immediate vicinity, you put this stuff. Bees forage in a circle of 1.5 to 2 miles. So you can see that the bees aren't going to go here anyhow, because they're going to be out everywhere else, so that the results are so diluted that you'd never find the stuff. And so that life cycle was accepted by EPA, and then I guess, as I jokingly tell some people, somebody must have laughed, because EPA went back and said, oh no, it isn't good enough. The consequence is that we have a pesticide on the market now that's not registered, and EPA doesn't do anything. And now, as we understand it, another study has been submitted, but we haven't been able to see it. It hasn't been peer-reviewed, and it's not official, but apparently it's out there. And from the information that I can get, they've expanded now from something like 2.5 acres to 5 acres, which is really the same story all over again. And so...
Yes, I've seen that second one, and the interesting aspect of that is they have made it public and concluded some things before they've even analyzed the data, and the suspicion is that this is purely a political move because of the vote that's pending in the European Union to ban some of these. But the interesting thing is they have quite literally outraged the scientific community, because, as it's been explained to me, this is just not done. You don't discuss the results of a study, one, before you've analyzed the data, and before it's been peer-reviewed and published. You just don't do that. So this study has a long history of mishandling and manipulation.
Well, I'd like to just mention something in there, Tom.
Pardon?
I'd just like to mention something in there that when researchers come out with something that Bayer doesn't like, they are held to the very strictest scientific criteria and even a little overkill. But when Bayer has an interest in protecting their own environment, all of a sudden, all this stuff goes out the window. And the same rules don't apply.
Now, the situation with the EPA is nothing new. Can you share with our audience a situation, or rather an event, that occurred back in the 1970s regarding something called PenCap MBKill?
Yes, PenCap-M was a microencapsulated methyl parathion. That's a very, very toxic cholinesterase inhibitor. That's a real bee killer. What would happen is that when this stuff was applied, the bees would pick it up as pollen, and they would pick it up both by landing on the plant, and these microencapsulated things would be in the pollen baskets, or there are other mechanisms where it actually is drawn electromagnetically to the bees, and they bring it back into the hive, and then it slowly poisons the bees. And so I was called up to investigate a bee kill in the 70s in Riverton, Wyoming, in which I was able to demonstrate that PenCap-M was involved in this bee kill. And interestingly enough, the agency used that properly to restrict this pesticide so that people couldn't buy it without a special license. Mm. You couldn't buy it in Safeway. And so that was in contradiction to a later investigation I did at the Mundell Honey Farms out in Idaho with an application of the same thing on blooming rapeseed. In that case, we had an open and shut case that this was the same thing as methylparathion, same evidence and everything else, yet the agency refused to take any action because they said, we don't have the technology to identify the capsules, and they didn't pay any attention to the rest of the evidence. Well, that convinced me I was in the wrong place, and I'd seen some other things like this, and that's what determined me to leave the pesticide program at the very first opportunity and to go work on PCBs where I could get something done.
And what was the date of those incidents? What year?
They were in the 70s, but I don't know the years right now. I'd have to try to go back through the files.
So these are problems of long standing, and what we're seeing with the neonicotinoids seem to fall within that pattern. Is that your...
They fall within the pattern. Apparently, EPA's first interest is to protect the chemical companies.
Now, Mr. Bench, since you've retired from the EPA, you've since taken a position of, I guess you would say, advocacy as far as the protection of honeybee health, and you've actually reached out to several politicians. Could you please share with our audience what you've been communicating to them and the response that you've received?
Well, first of all, I've always wanted to be an advocate for honeybees because I've seen what was going on. But generally, I didn't do much because I worked for the Environmental Protection Agency. It could always come back on me. But I've become more public about that since I retired, and I sent a letter to 9 senators whom I had heard were interested in this honeybee problem. There just seems to be a great lack of knowledge about the environment and the world that people live in by a lot of our population. I sent this to them. In the first letter, I had poor policy as a subject, poor science as a public subject, and poor management. The poor policy, of course, is the conditional registration that allows EPA to give conditional registrations for products that haven't been properly tested. The best information I have is that 2/3 of the pesticides have been issued under conditional registration, which I think is just a big, big error. The second one was poor science, and I just gave you an example of that with the study that came in. And then the third one was poor management. And because some of these studies, like the one I mentioned, are so absurd, any fourth grader knows better. Yet management overrode their scientists who says there's some real problems here. We need to do a life cycle study. You shouldn't just put it on the market. It's highly toxic to PCBs. And they overrode, apparently, the science and issued a conditional registration. Anyhow, those are the things that I pointed out that needed to be corrected. That letter was sent out on 2 December 2012. I didn't hear anything at all, so I sent another letter dated 16 January, in which I asked about the status of these things, in which I explained further what the consequences are and are going to be this looming environmental catastrophe, which is much, much bigger than honeybees. And so far, I haven't heard anything. And that sort of confirms what I wish I didn't know, is that there's a lot of people on this planet that don't even know what Earth is.
Nor seem to care.
Well, yeah, that goes along with it.
They
don't even know what planet they're on.
Politicians, if they haven't answered your questions, what do you think the next step will be for you with the congressman?
I'm kind of at a loss what to do. I think I'm going to write another letter, and then I probably will make phone calls to them to find out what's happening. At that point, I'm not sure what to do with these letters. I can revise some of them. I think they're pretty good, and I'll send them around to some environmental groups, although I recognize that there are a lot of environmental groups who are very concerned about this and who can't get heard any more than I can.
We've talked a bit. We've been friends for many years. We've talked a bit about your plans, but maybe you can explain to the listeners what you see as your future as a beekeeper. Do you plan to do?
That really is a concern of mine, because I've had bees for 35 years, and as I mentioned, during that 35 years, I have always had bees within the city limits of Boulder, and I've always gotten a good crop of honey. And about 8 or 9 years ago, I began to have some new problems that I'd never seen before. I had some bees on the edge of Boulder, and they wouldn't build up. For 5 years, I never had any harvest at all. You just couldn't get the colonies to grow. And every year I would come out and I would find a couple of my colonies dead, or even more to the point. And I even had a colony in the living room that this happened to. I went in there in February and I found a hive full of honey and no bees.
What was it doing in your living room?
Well, it wasn't up there in the corner. This is a glass-sided hive.
Oh, I see.
They have their own entrance. And so it's just my big fish tank, except that I don't have to feed them. My fish fly and feed themselves.
An observation hive. I understand now.
Yeah. Let's see. I've lost track of where I was here.
So your plans. What do you see?
Oh, my plans. My plans.
As a beekeeper.
After having lost my bees for the first time in 35 years, I have no bees now.
Wow.
One of the things that happens is you have bees. It's like being a smoker, but I really didn't like to use that. But once a smoker, always a smoker. But once a beekeeper, always a beekeeper. And that latter is one of the things you don't want to stop.
Yeah,
so
I've said you don't keep bees, you marry them.
That's right. And you miss them when they're gone.
Yeah.
And it's very upsetting to have your neighbors killing your bees. So I have decided I'm going to reinstitute my bees, but I'm going to move them in Denver, because I know of four locations in the city of Boulder now where bees have either seriously affected or died, and I don't feel that I want to even try to keep bees in Boulder anymore. Boulder is this environmental community that is being poisoned, and not only are the bees being poisoned, but all the pollinators are being poisoned. People are putting this stuff on their roses, on their plants, on their grass. It's water soluble. It travels. It gets expressed in all of the flowers, and it kills all of the pollinators, and it stays there for years.
The lemon trees alone are a very important vector. They're commonly used in landscaping. They're very attractive, and they're in almost all urban landscapes. They're also called the boxwood in some parts of the country, but anyone who lives in town, keeps bees, should be aware of what the management practices are in their particular town, I think.
And also, folks, I just want to point out that if you're not sure about the chemicals that you're about to purchase, you should read the labels and ask. You should also take a look at
the application instructions, but for the most part, if they do contain the neonicotinoids, the systemic pesticides that we've been talking about, by all means, do not purchase them.
Well, it's also important that when you purchase a pesticide, don't concern yourself so much with somebody's rose spray or somebody's turf grass, but go to the active ingredient statement on the label, and it will tell you what's in it. And you need to look out for three big ones right now, thiamethoxin, imidacloprid, and clothianidin.
Yes.
Imidacloprid is the way you pronounce it. Once again,
yes.
Clothianidin, that's the one that we're really concerned with right now with the conditional registration. Imidacloprid, which is another real bee killer, and thiamethoxin.
Yeah, imidacloprid is the one most commonly used in urban environments. We've talked a lot about agriculture, but the urban environment is apparently equally hostile to life.
Well, I agree with that, and that's another thing as far as future of keeping bees. The last refuge for bees in the city is disappearing rapidly. You can't have bees survive in large portions of our agricultural community, and now this stuff is moving into the city, and especially here in Boulder, so probably everywhere else in a big way because it's a moneymaker.
I'm very interested to see how you do in Denver, Dan.
Yeah.
I think we all are, and I would love to have you come back on the show, Mr. Bench. But we are out of time, and I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your experience not only as a former EPA worker but also as a beekeeper.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic Bee Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.